Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction. So today's talk started off in a collaboration with Lev Yoffe at Rutgers, and then I did much more thorough work later on with Sergei Pankov, who also started a very similar work as we did with Yoffe, together with Vlad Dobrosavljevic. And I'll present first steps that we did together with Lev, and then show you the relations between Coulomb or electron glasses and long-range spin glasses, and some very peculiar relationships between some pseudo gaps that often occur in glassy phases, and the structure with which one solves these glasses. So I will start off with an introduction to the glasses we consider. It's glasses with quench disorder, long-range spin glasses, and electron glasses. And I'll emphasize the glassy behavior on one side, which is well known in spin glasses, not so well known in electron glasses. I'll review that and show you also the occurrence of pseudo gaps in both systems. And then I'll present a theoretical approach to those systems that allows us to understand what is happening at the glass transition, and that there is a glass transition at all. And I will spend some time explaining to you the physics of replica symmetry breaking and how one can understand it in simple terms. And then I'll focus on low temperature, on the low temperature regime, so far below TC, and I'll show you that there are very interesting universal properties coming out in that regime. And if there's time left, I'll try to make some connection between those results that we obtain here and the experiments. So in very broad terms, we're going to deal with glasses with quenched disorder. That means systems that have, for example, random fields, like in the Coulomb glass problem, or quenched random interactions, as in the spin glass problem. And the basic phenomenon that takes place is that there are strong interactions between spins or between electrons, and they are frustrated by the disorder, which leads to generically to glassy behavior and to the absence of some simple order. So for example, if you have an electronic system with no quench disorder, you're most likely to get into a Mott insulator at low temperatures, and that has of course a simple order. But that doesn't happen if you have sufficient randomness, but you get some kind of spin glass order. That means randomly patterned pure states. And what is also very different in these kind of materials is that there is not only one or two pure states that can appear at low temperatures, but many. And there's a multitude of metastable states in which you can get trapped and which are at the basis of metastability. Now, the absence of a simple order, like in a Mott insulator, leads actually to the absence of hard gaps in the excitation spectrum, and instead gives rise to soft pseudo gaps. And one of the aims of this talk is to show you the close relationship between pseudo gaps and some intriguing property of these glasses, which is their marginal stability.
I have to ask the mandatory question here. Mm-hmm. The many different pure states, you talk about finite dimensional systems? Are you talking about mean field, which you're going to be looking at more, and the relationship with metastable states?
Yeah, right. So I'll be talking about the mean field spin glass, which is the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model on one side. So I'm not claiming there is a relationship with three-dimensional Edwards-Anderson spin glasses, short range, but I also apply to electron glasses, which are Coulomb interacting electron system in finite dimensions, where we believe that this kind of mean field theory is a good approximation. And I will justify why we think so. So spin glasses probably are more familiar to everybody. I'll give a brief review too, but here let me explain what Coulomb glasses are, or electron glasses. These are Anderson insulators, that is, localized electrons, for example, in a doped semiconductor, with strong electron-electron interactions. And the interactions are strong because the Coulombian interactions are not screened because there are no conduction electrons. And in the limit of strong localization, we get basically a classical Hamiltonian of electrons that can live on sites I. Say I have either a regular cubic lattice or I have a random lattice, and on each side there can be one or zero electrons described by the occupation number n equals zero or one. There are Coulomb interactions. There is a, say, a background charge that neutralizes the system globally that can be influenced by a background gate voltage to change the overall charge content. And there is randomness in the form of a local disorder, which I take to be Gaussian with the width W. So we have strong interactions, repulsive interactions, and disorder here. And if you wish, we could also put disorder in the position of the sites, but that's not essential. I will consider a regular lattice with just on-site disorder of this form. So it's a random field, anti-ferromagnetic spin-glass problem in a sense, if we look at this variable as a spin. If the average charge per site is 1/2, we have exactly a spin problem, then this variable is plus minus 1/2, and we have a long-range anti-ferromagnetic spin glass.
Yeah. And
this here, that is the randomness of, say, the localization energy, or you can say that the defect structure that that pins the electron is random. And we are actually going to work in the limit where this randomness is very strong as compared to, say, the nearest neighbor interaction. In that limit, we have a well-controlled approach. Now, this kind of systems, these electron glasses, have been considered long ago, and the first one to observe that there's something funny going on was Mike Pollack, and then Efros and Shklovsky have worked very much on that kind of problem. Pointed out that there's a pseudo gap in this problem, and later on, Davis, Patrick Lee, and Maurice Rice have pointed out that this system should actually be glassy. But for a long time, the connection between these two aspects, the pseudo gap aspect and the glassiness, has not been understood, and that's another aim of this talk, to make this connection. So, this pseudo gap, or Efros-Shklovsky Coulomb gap. What is that? If you tunnel in such into such a system, so you take a piece of your Anderson insulator with strong interactions, you put the gate on it and you try to tunnel into it, that it's pretty hard because it's an insulator. But if you do that carefully, you see that the tunneling conductance has a strong depletion around zero voltage. So what you're probing here is the tunneling density of states, and if you're in the strongly insulating limit, what you're actually sensitive to is the distribution of local energies to put an extra electron into the system. And the local energy is just the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to n, so it's composed out of the local disorder energy plus interaction with all other particles in the system. And what Efros and Shklovsky observed is that the distribution of these local energies must have at least a soft gap around zero. And that was finally observed experimentally in this tunneling experiment, which really directly probes this quantity. On the other hand, it was... Yeah.
What did they do to come to the conclusion? Can you remind us?
That I will review in a few further slides. So on the other hand, the indirect evidence was very clear, or has been seen in many materials in the form of the Hopping conduction, which is activated but with a stretched exponential. And this stretched exponential actually reflects, the power here reflects the power in the depression of the density of things.
Well, that was g-dimensional, right? This is yes. g-1 or something like that.
Right.
Of e.
This power here is d-1, yes. That will.
There are beautiful experiments in two dimensions on films, which also show very clear.
yes, there are experiments. They show power of one, but whether it's the Coulomb gap or not is pretty debatable.
Where do you call this a soft gap?
Soft gap means that there are states, but they are power law suppressed. The hard gap would be zero. Yes, right. So here is as a function of T. You see that at high temperatures there is nothing, and then at low temperatures, which correspond about to these voltages, and there is this feature developing. And just recognize the difference with, say, MOT insulator, where you would have a charged ordered state, then you would have a hard gap. It's basically just the Madelung constant, which you would have to pay to remove an electron from its site. So the fact that we have here no hard gap is related to the
You call MOT insulator a regular thing.
Yes, right. Okay, just a regular charge one. Now, so that is the Coulomb glass side. Now let me remind you the long-range spin glass is the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. That is a model of n spins with random bond interactions, Jij, which have a variance that goes like 1 over n to make the system well-defined in the thermodynamic limit. And we will also add random local fields, Hi, both with a Gaussian distribution. Now, if you analyze that just numerically, for example, that is from a paper by Dobrosavljevic and Pastor, then you and you plot the distribution of local fields, which is dH by dS, so the sum over jij sj plus hi. If you plot the histogram of that, you find also a linear suppression of sites with a low local field. So it's a linear pseudo gap around the chemical potential, if you want. And this is very suggestive to think that there is a connection between this Coulomb gap and this kind of gap. And indeed, that was already mentioned by Anderson, I think, 25 years ago in his Lesouche lectures. And it was stressed again quite a bit by Dobrosavljevic, in particular in this paper. But the precise connection was never really clear, and then we'll now explore that in more detail.
Do you get that linear gap by applying an Efrosh-Glotsky type argument?
Yes.
This model?
Yes, you can, yeah.
So then, doesn't that make the origin clear?
Right, but, well, so this argument that I will review in two further slides gives you a suggestion that this gap has at least to be like this, but you, as in this case, if you do this argument, you can just say it has to be at least linear, and then if you go further and you solve the spin glass, for example, then I think Bray and Moore were the first to recognize that the solution is actually marginally stable, and that this marginal stability has something to do with this linear gap, and finally it was solved. Exactly, say the equations by Parisi were solved exactly by Sommers and Dupont, and they showed that this has to come out. And we are now going to establish this connection in more detail and do the same for the Coulomb glass, and I will show you how this all fits together.
So the only difference between these two systems is the way in which the interaction falls off the distance.
Well, in principle, it's also that the electron system has no quenched randomness in the interaction. It's just repulsive. So that might make you think that it's actually pretty different, but in some limit, there is an effective randomness in the interactions that arises at. Well, because you're interacting with so many particles and you have indirect interactions in the electron system as well, so the effective interaction is pretty random. So that was the pseudo gap part of the story. On the other hand, there were recent experiments, say, in the last 15 years and over the last 5 or 10 years, even more in several groups, that showed that there's indeed glassy behavior on the insulating side of the metal insulator transition in several systems. The system that was most thoroughly studied is indium oxide by Ovadiao from Jerusalem. He looks at two-dimensional films of indium oxide that are controlled by a gate voltage, a background gate that controls the average charge density in this film. The charge density is only changed by, say, 5% with respect to the charge density that you already have, but you can see how conductance along the film varies as a function of gate voltage. Now, if you take a film that is not very insulating, then you just see a normal field effect. The conductance rises when you inject more carriers by the gate. However, if you take a really insulating film that is susceptible to be a glass, then the conductance rises from your equilibration point, but it also rises on the other side. Also, when you deplete carriers, the conductance goes up, and that's a clear out-of-equilibrium phenomenon. So, but now if you go up here and you wait for a long time at this gate voltage, then the conductance goes down and finally reaches a point down here. And if you did that for every point, you would get again a normal field effect. But this you would only observe after hours and hours of waiting. So the system is clearly glassy in that aspect. And it's supposedly an electron glass. Similar effects were seen in granular aluminium by a group in Grenoble, and there are many other experiments by Goldman's group, for example, in Minnesota, and complementary experiments closer to the metal insulator transition that show glassy behavior. And that's just one aspect. There's a generically very slow relaxation of conductivity. There are aging effects and memory effects that are very interesting. So all of this suggests that indeed these systems are glassy. And now we would like to understand, is there indeed a connection between the Coulomb gap that I was showing you and this glassy behavior? Further, we would like to understand why the Coulomb gap is actually so universal, in the sense that this this power law suppression is actually always there and never dependent on the system that you're considering. And then I will focus actually on low temperatures, and I will show you that indeed universality arises at low temperature. And if you have time, I'll speak a bit about aging in the end. So now comes the review of the Coulomb gap, this simple argument that tells you that there has to be at least a soft gap in the ground state. Now imagine we have our arrangement of electrons over a lattice. They are occupied and empty sides, and we are in the ground state, say, at zero temperature. Being in the ground state means that whenever I take an electron from an occupied side to an empty side, I have to gain energy. Now, the local energy of this occupied side is E1, this is E2. If I move this electron over here, I pay this much energy, but at the same time, I gain the particle-hole interaction here. Or in other words, there's a double counting within E1 and E2 of the interaction between these two sides, and that I have to subtract. So in order to ensure that this move costs me energy, I have to have that this sum is bigger than E squared over R, this particle-hole interaction. And that immediately implies you that you cannot have too high a density of states close to the Fermi level, because otherwise you would find two sides, one occupied, one empty, where this relation is violated. If you do that a bit more precisely, you can say, okay, let's take a side that is close to the Fermi level, occupied. Then I don't want another side to be close enough to violate this constraint. So in a radius R of E, of an energy E, which is E squared over E, I don't want to have another side, because that would violate immediately this constraint. That gives, in this volume, you want the integrated density of states from 0 to E to be smaller or equal to 1, roughly. And that imposes immediately that this density of states here has to go like e to the dimension minus 1. Otherwise, you would get, on average, a violation of this constraint. That's basically the argument of Efros-Shklovsky, and it tells you that the pseudo-gap in the density of states or in the distribution of local fields has to be at least suppressed by d minus 1. And in three dimensions, this would be a parabola. In two dimensions, linear. Sorry? No, basically not. So it was a major puzzle to understand why this is seemingly always observed. You see in Hopping conduction that this power always leads to the stretched exponential of 1/2. So this seems to be a very good argument, but why it works so well has never been thoroughly understood. And also, maybe even the prefactor is universal. So in order to approach this problem, we developed with Lev and simultaneously Sergei and Vlad Dobrosavljevic a locator approximation, which is based on a systematic high-temperature expansion. From that, we will obtain first the glass transition. We will understand it as a breakdown of screening due to strong fluctuations. And then we will see that marginal stability in the glass phase will play a crucial role to explain why this Coulomb gap is saturated and why this power law suppression is so universal. And more insight comes from a low temperature analysis where we can make a connection with RG flows. So this high temperature expansion was very nicely explained in a paper by Johnson and Khmelnytsky 10 years ago. So you take our classical statistical mechanics problem of electrons on a lattice with 1 over r interactions and random disorder here with strength w, and then we'll focus on the simpler case where there's one particle on every two sides. So we have a spin representation which is the occupation number minus 1/2, so the s is a variable that an easing variable that is plus minus 1/2, and we have the interactions 1 over r.
So to connect to the previous thing, so nu is somehow the gate voltage? Or?
Yes, yeah.
So, and that was important to for this non-equilibrium.
Right, span, yeah.
Right? So somehow you have to control nu in some way, right?
I think that's just a convenient way for experimentalists to perturb the system and look at its response, but you can also perturb with temperature or so. It's just less neat because gate voltage you can switch on and it's immediately it's temperature always you have we could treat nu arbitrary. We cannot but one would have to work harder if you want to understand what happens when you change nu and so on. But we now work at nu fixed and in particular nu equals 1/2, which is just convenient. Now, so let us write down the partition functions, just sum over all spins of eta minus beta Hamiltonian. And then it is convenient to introduce conjugated variables to the spin so that we have a field theory in continuous variables. We trace out the spins, and that gives, in principle, a field theory in the variables phi, which are basically mean local energies if you look at it carefully. And then, if we choose to do so, we can average over the disorder, which still sits in these local fields, and use replicas to calculate the quenched average. We will do that in the end in order to describe the glass phase, but we can first start without doing that and just do high temperature expansion and see what happens. So if I look at the disorder average correlations, everything looks pretty normal. So I look at two spins at distance r between sites I and J. And what I have to do in the high temperature expansion is sum these screening diagrams. I have the direct interaction, which is 1 over T times the interaction, 1 over R, and then I have insertions with coming from the local disorder, and these are the leading diagrams. I just have a polarizability on each side, and the average polarizability goes like 1 over disorder. So what I get is very natural. I just get the Yukawa potential, a screened 1 over R interaction, because I have an average polarizability. And it looks like nothing special would happen. But this is too simplistic.
What's the energy scale?
Okay. This is a nearest neighbor interaction. So this would be A is the lattice spacing of my cubic lattice, and this would be E squared over A. And we are, let me say that again, we are working in the regime where the disorder is much bigger than this nearest neighbor interaction. So many spins are actually quenched because they see a very strong random field, and they don't care about what their neighbors do because the random field is so strong. And that makes that this screening length that appears here is actually very large, because the polarizability is low. So effectively you end up with a system where the interactions are still very long ranged. It's screened on very long scales, but you interact with a lot of neighbors, and that suggests finally that we can use mean field theory to describe the situation better later. So on the level of average correlation functions, nothing particular seems to happen, but the same problem arises when you look at spin glasses, and also in the say in the Anderson transition, if you look at the average density of states, nothing seems to happen at the localization transition. That is actually on this level same. Now, to see what that something goes on, you have to look at fluctuations of this correlator. And if you calculate the connected square expectation value over disorder of this screening series, then what you have to sum are diagrams like this, where each line now is such a sum of simple lines, and the red dot is the connected square of this expression here. And now this series diverges or becomes critical at a finite temperature. And what it tells you basically is that this exponential goes away, and we have critical correlations in the system, but with a random sign, because here if we just average directly, we get still an exponential decay. So
I have a sort of technical question. I mean, when you go to this conjugate variable, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's known in simple derivations, it's simplizing all this. It's very fishy, actually, because the matrix that you get of the inversion is not positive definite. So it's really a trick which doesn't work. It's somehow it's a misleading treatment of the problem. To get 5/4 normalizing in that way is wrong. It's just not correct. So do you have the same problem here?
I wasn't aware of that problem, but actually at this we don't really use that. You don't have to go to that to the conjugate variables. I just found it more convenient in the beginning, but basically you can do all the derivation that we are doing also in spin space. But
In general, you can handle this problem by a little continuing example. You can discuss
what the books usually say is you add a diagonal interaction which doesn't change anything. You don't like that.
Uh-huh, yes.
Well, maybe.
So, okay. Now, this was probably the most physical, insightful thing I can give you to see that something is happening at a certain finite scale, namely that, average screening is still there, but if you look at the particular screening between two sides, it's actually not there. The screening has been destroyed by two strong fluctuations in the local polarizability. Another view of seeing that something has to go on in the system is that you look at the back reaction of the environment, the presence of a spin. This is known in spin glasses as the Onsager back reaction. And you can, the spin that sits here polarizes a neighboring spin, and this polarization acts back on the spin, and that gives you an extra field that the spin sees. And it's actually very important in the description of spin glasses. Here we have to work a bit more because this kind of diagrams is divergent. If you have 1 over R interactions, you get 1 over R squared integrated over the volume that diverges. So you have to sum all these multiple screening diagrams, and this gives you the Onsager reaction for the Coulomb glasses. And the idea is, if this reaction is as strong as the temperature, you will get a transition to a collective correlated state. And indeed, this gives you the same temperature scale as the argument before, saying that at a TC, which goes like 1 over square root of the disorder, there is something going on in the system. There's a transition. But what is interesting now is that to note that this temperature scale is exactly what Efros and Shklovsky from their simple argument would predict for the width of their Coulomb gap. So strongly indicative that there is a close connection between the two. And the third point of view would come from the mean field theory with replicas where we do a local approximation. I'll explain that in a minute, where we see that at this scale, exactly at this scale, there's an instability of the high temperature phase, which is replica symmetric, and replica symmetry is broken in the low temperature phase. And from that point of view, we'll see that the glass transition is in the same universality class as in the random field long-range spin glass model. So these are three views to see the glass transition. Now, before we go on with some technical details, let me give you some flavor of what is happening then in the low temperature phase. The general idea is that there is a large number of pure states in the low temperature phase, and that shows up as a difference between field cooled and zero field cooled compressibility in charge systems or susceptibility in spin systems. And just to illustrate this, these are results that we obtained from the mean field theory. At TC, there is a clear split between the zero field cooled compressibility and the field cooled compressibility, which remains basically constant, whereas this decreases like T squared, reflecting the Efros-Shklovsky Coulomb gap. Now, if you have a large number of states and metastable configurations, there is at least weakly broken ergodicity. That means you have very long timescales until you explore your phase space. And finally, a very important property of this mean field kind glasses or glasses with long-range interaction is the property of marginal stability. The idea is that as you approach TC from above, there is this divergence of the connected correlation function squared, and that tells you that the zero field compressibility has a near divergence, and in particular that the correlation functions are critical. And the idea is that in the whole low temperature phase, this will remain true, not just at the transition, but in the whole glass phase. And that is certainly true in the spin glass case, and we also expect it to be true in the electron glass case. And that has very important consequences for experiments. First, it might furnish a possibility detect the glass phase by somehow probing these non-local correlation functions that only decay algebraically. On the other hand, marginal stability, which is connected with this phenomenon, would tell you that there are a lot of soft collective modes in the system, which would clearly have an impact on activated transport. That is to be explored in a quantum model of this system. So that was just to give you some flavor of what to expect at low temperatures. But now we have to also do something at low temperatures. And here, the most convenient thing is to use the replica drink. So we start.
Can I ask, so with the high temperature diagrammatics that you described, is there any small parameter which justifies picking out the things that you resummed?
Yes, all right, so that's just what I'm coming to here. So we start from this high temperature expansion, and well, here I work in the with conjugated fields. So I write the Dyson equation for this correlation function. The full propagator is bare propagator plus a geometric series of self-energy insertions. And now you look at the self-energy, and there are two types of diagrams. There are diagonal diagrams that all come back to the same point, and there are off-diagonal diagrams which go from one to another point. And you analyze what is the relative magnitude of these diagrams, and you find that this kind of diagrams is suppressed with respect to that by a pretty large power of inverse disorder. I think there's probably a beta missing here. But this kind of off-diagonal diagrams is clearly suppressed, and it suggests that we approximate the self-energy as a local insertion. That is actually the same thing that happens in what is used in dynamical mean field theory, where in order to do that you invoke actually a large dimensionality, where also such a thing happens. Here it happens because we have large disorder that makes the interactions nearly unscreened, so you have long-range interactions, and that suggests that the self-energy is again more or less a local object. And once we have that, it suggests that we map to an effective single-site model which resums all the local self-energy contributions. So that the idea is to start from this original lattice model and seek a local model which just lives on one side and has replicas A and B, or N replicas of the system with a quadratic interaction that replaces the J here and the same disorder term that you get after replicating here, such that if you solve this system, this model exactly, then you resum basically all the diagrams with local self-energy insertions here. And of course you have to do that self-consistently, so you have to choose this lambda AB in the right way, and the natural condition is to impose that the so-called overlap or the local correlation function between different replicas evaluates to the same thing in both models, assuming that you have the same local self-energy in both models. And that suffices to determine this lambda AB as a function of temperature.
If you had chosen mu different from one half,
yes.
Would you have still a single site?
Yes, yeah.
Like this, or would you have to choose different kinds of sites?
No, that would be still the same. Right. So it's worthwhile to point out that if you do this kind of reasoning for the SK spin glass, then you get an exact approximation, so, an exact treatment. It's not an approximation. You get exactly the saddle point equations that Parisi derived for the spin glasses. And here in the Coulomb glass, it's just a good approximation, the limit where disorder is large. Now, before I go on describing what happens, we have to decide how now to choose this matrix lambda AB. So it's a coupling matrix in replica space, and in principle there are infinitely many ways that you could treat this matrix once it is not replica symmetric anymore. That which you have to break the replica symmetry in the low temperature phase, because we saw that the high temperature phase where this matrix just has two components, the diagonal and the off-diagonal, this solution becomes unstable and you know that you have to break replica symmetry, meaning that you have not the same value of lambda in the off diagonal. Now, Parisi has suggested how to do that, and he said you should take this matrix of n times m, and you group the replicas in blocks, and certain blocks in bigger blocks, and so on. You create an ultrametric hierarchy of replica clusters, and these are supposed to reflect actually the valley structure in energy landscape. So roughly speaking, you can think of a little block as a little valley in the energy landscape, and bigger blocks as bigger valleys, and so on. And the size of the blocks actually parametrizes the distribution of the mean energy level of the valleys. So a block of size X corresponds to groups of valleys whose bottoms are distributed exponentially with the parameter X here multiplying beta times the free energy of the valley. That has come out after long work on the SK model, this kind of interpretation. And the idea is, of course, in the end, to take the number of replicas to zero. And furthermore, in the spin glass problem and also in this problem here, as it will turn out, we'll have continuous replica symmetry breaking. That means that we take the number of clusters to infinity, and the matrix can finally be described by a continuous function of this size x going from 1 to n, and n goes to 0, so this will be a function living on the space x between 0 and 1.
I was not following this literature.
Yeah.
A long time, so maybe you can update me. So in another problem of this random manifolds, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could have a variational Gaussian approach where you would need some replica symmetry breaking to solve the problem.
Yeah.
But you also had an alternative approach using functional algebra.
Yes.
And they somehow converge, right? They show
right.
The same thing, right?
Yeah, in large.
An alternative treatment to the spin glass which avoids replica symmetry breaking.
Yes. So in the spin glass problem, it has been proven 1 or 2 years ago that this procedure gives the exact free energy, and that was proven without a replica trick. I mean, rigorously mathematically.
What's the way of doing it?
It's basically interpolating Hamiltonians. You start from a trivial Hamiltonian where you know the answer. You write down a differential equation for the free energy as a parameter is changed, and then you get the final answer because you can integrate this differential equation. Basically,
what's the reference for the
answer? Francesco Guerra did that, or Talago, yeah, right. Okay, so I told you what Parisi's contribution was, basically that this the core of the insight how to break replica symmetry. But for my purpose, it will be more useful to think of the dynamical interpretation that was given by Sompolinski shortly after Parisi came out with this solution. And he rederived the same solution by suggesting that there is a hierarchy of timescales, each one much bigger than the one before, and you start with microscopic timescales corresponding to the diagonal here on the matrix. And you have this hierarchical sequence of timescales, and you look at the dynamics going from one timescale to the other, and you do mean field theory in that framework, and you recover basically exactly what the structure of the Parisi solution. And the only thing that I will need from that is that we will interpret the x variable actually as some kind of time variable in this Sompolinski sense. So large x corresponds to small time and vice versa. Okay, so now the second step, or the second ingredient to the low temperature solution is how to actually solve such a problem with a Parisi structure here in the lambda AB. Actually, Bertrand worked that out in the summer school when Parisi gave a talk on that topic. And the idea is just that you successively integrate out from the center to the end of the matrix, and you try to evaluate the partition function of this model by going stepwise outside. And if the replica symmetry breaking is continuous, this gives you a differential equation. This is just an algebraic trick in principle, but you can also interpret it physically. Namely, you ask yourself, what is the magnetization at the time scale t corresponding to x if I impose a frozen field from all other spins sitting out here and frozen on the time scale x? What is the magnetization on this frozen time scale t if I have a frozen field y acting on the spin? This gives a magnetization as a function of x time and the field y. And on the other hand, I also ask for the distribution of these frozen fields created by other spins. And you can now interpret this algebraic trick to solve this kind of Hamiltonian and write actually down flow equations for this distribution of fields and magnetization functions as a function of the field and time. And in the flow equations, dots correspond to time derivatives or x derivatives, and primes are field derivatives. So we get some kind of temporal flow equations for these two objects that you can now solve. And finally, you have to impose self-consistency of your mean field treatment. That means that you have to impose that the overlap has the right self-consistency property, and that gives you a condition on the lambda of x that you inject here. And all information about the model, namely dimensionality of the Coulomb glass and the interaction, sits in the self-consistency.
Mark, what tells you how many steps of replica symmetry breaking you have to do, or where you have to go to the continuous? What's the mechanism of truncating this thing?
Right. The philosophy is you start basically with one step and then with two steps.
Is it a stability matrix or is it so
forth? Yes. Well, you just look, do you get stable solutions? You have to optimize the free energy over the space of lambda ABs. And you optimize, and then you usually it's like this. If one step is...
You have to go over.
Yes, then usually... Yeah. Right. And,
Are you telling us that the mean field spin class is not exactly the same, or is there no problem, or
on the level of the approximation that we make, it turns out. It's the same. It gives a Hamiltonian like this, right? We make a local approximation, but they differ on the level of the self-consistency, which. On this level, you will get a different condition how to choose the lambda AB. And so we'll get different low temperature answers. So now to relax a bit, I'll show you what comes out if we really solve these equations self-consistently. Here are two results for different disorders. This is large disorder, small disorder, as a function of temperature. Below the critical temperature, above the critical temperature, the distribution of local fields is just a Gaussian that we basically put in, slightly renormalized. So this is this curve. And then at TC, as a gap starts to open, and indeed you see the Coulomb gap forming. That will convince you that this is indeed the Evros-Klofsky Coulomb.
So local energies now, or?
So P of y was this distribution of local fields, and I should have said that local fields are basically just these local energies that you probe in a tunneling experiment.
Okay, a question regarding the last slide. But the random manifold problem, I guess in some large n limit, the replica symmetry breaking solution is identical to the functional IG, I understand.
Yes, well.
Is there a similar solution for probabilistic distributions available in that random manifold problem, such a simple equation?
Probabilistic
distributions for that other problem?
In the limit of large n of the manifolds, you get also these flow equations.
Okay, there's a similar.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's just a generic property whenever you have a mean field.
I understand.
Yeah. Okay, so one thing is you see very nicely that a Coulomb gap is opening in both cases. The Bayer disorder is large, so the distribution is broad, but the low energy properties are actually the same. You don't see that here, but you will see it later.
Could you remind us how TC scales with the disorder strength when the disorder
strength? Yes, it goes like TC goes like W to the 1 over T minus 1. So which is natural that because you start with the Bayer density of stage, which goes like 1 over W, and then here you have a pseudo gap that goes like 1 e to the d minus 1, and this point scales in that way. So in this critical energy or temperature scale.
So the condition for the terms that you left out involved the disorder strength, and it also involved temperature.
Condition for temperature.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Well, when you were comparing the diagonal and off-diagonal contributions to mm-hmm. the energy, the off-diagonal ones were suppressed by some inverse power of the disorder strength, but you also had temperature in there. If you sit, so my question is, if you sit at the critical temperature, does the fact that critical temperature goes down with disorder strength compensate?
I certainly checked that, and it does not. That's okay. What I can see.
Marcus, so your temperature is going up as the disorder becomes weaker.
Yes.
You said that your theory is only good for very strong disorders.
Right.
What's the reason why it breaks down when you decrease the disorders?
If the disorder is decreased, then the screening length is basically lattice spacing, and then you are not long range anymore, and then, yeah. So, I have to speed up a bit. So, if we look, I just flashed you these results, but that's theoretically not very telling. But if you look now at low temperature, then first thing is, since we empirically see that we have continuous replica symmetry breaking with the lambda of x that is continuous, this immediately implies the marginal stability of the low temperature state. And that means that your pure states that you get are not very stable, but they have flat directions in phase space. And in particular, so if you expand around the local minimum, you have an excitation spectrum that is gapless. And that's particularly important for a quantum glass, actually. Now, if you analyze the consequence of this marginal stability in the flow equations, you can see that at low temperature, the distribution of local fields or the local density of states has to assume this this scaling form T squared, reflecting the Eprost-Shklovsky exponent times the scaling function of the field over temperature. And for large fields, this suggests immediately that you have a parabola in three dimensions, which is indeed this Eprost-Shklovsky exponent. And if you repeat the analysis in different dimensions and different interactions, you get the Eprost-Shklovsky exponent out. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us that this marginal stability of the glass is kind of connected to the exhaustion of density of states or the saturation of the Eprost-Shklovsky bound. And it's relatively intuitive. You say that the glass is just stable enough not to be unstable, so it exhausts all degrees of freedom that are there, and so you should just get to the bound of stability. And therefore, it's not such a surprise that the Frosklovsky argument is saturated. Now you can ask further question, why is that also, or what is the dependence on this order now? It's not very visible. As a function of temperature, you seem to flow to some scaling function, actually, as I claimed here. You also see that numerically you approach some kind of fixed point psi here. But now if you look at the different disorders, you superpose these limiting curves, and they just look the same. So the low temperature results just don't seem to care about disorder. And how does this come about? Let me go through that a bit quickly. For that, we rewrite the equation in natural variables. We rescale the time variable x with beta, and we actually recognize a combination that's known as the effective temperature in out of equilibrium response, and we rescale the field with this effective temperature, and we write magnetization and field distributions in this rescaled form. And now we look at the flow equations again, and now it takes a very suggestive form. We have something like a renormalization equation. A dA of m is a functional of m, which is a function of field, and the only place where the time or A appears is here, and the same for the field distribution. Now it turns out that the self-consistent solution imposes that this thing basically goes to a constant on intermediate time scales. So all looks like you get renormalization equations in temporal flow for these two quantities. And moreover, you can now expect that you flow to a fixed point on intermediate time scales where this is a constant. And this is indeed what happens in these flow equations. You get fixed points in this Parisi flow, which is just a solution of the mean field problem on one hand, but it has also a physical interpretation, because this means that on intermediate time scales you get some universal behavior. And this all happens at temperatures which are very small as compared to TC. Now, one immediate consequence is that since these fixed points don't care about initial conditions, the disorder drops out of the problem. The disorder only comes into the problem as a boundary condition, and since you flow to fixed point, it doesn't care anymore. So that explains why we got this universal density of states. On the other hand, if you now look more closely what the fixed point means, and you look at the distribution of magnetizations that you find at the time scale x, you find actually that the fixed point forces you that you will have a universal distribution of magnetizations, and the only thing that changes as a function of time is the number of degrees of freedom that contribute there. I will not go into the meaning of the effective temperature.
Slowing it down. But so at some point you had a diagrammatic approach.
Mm-hmm.
Whether there was some parameter that was related to the strength of the disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So is the statement now that this RG effectively sums the diagrams better in a sense, and then you don't worry about this parameter anymore? It can be small now? Sort of I'm lost in this logic, I'm somehow lost. So do you care about the strength of the disorder now, or you don't really?
No, once we believe we can make this local approximation, the disorder finally drops out of the...
Which means that if you were able to sum the diagrams properly, you would get the same result, more or less.
Yes, probably, yes. Uh-huh. And, yeah, it's just not clear whether in low disorder you don't get another kind of ordering.
This RG equations, do they apply only to the low temperature phases that we're seeing?
They apply everywhere, but the fixed point occurs in the flow on intermediate values of A, and for that, so when when A, which is this beta x, is of order 1 or close to 1, it doesn't, when x is of close to 1, it does not apply. It also does not apply when beta x is of order 1 over the critical temperature. So you need a window where this fixed point can be approached, and that forces you to be at low temperature.
But it describes the ultimate low temperature behavior.
Yes, right, right.
System.
Yeah. And in part, yeah.
Yeah, so you say it's RG, but it's still within mean field. It's RG with very easy.
Yes.
The continuous variable,
yeah.
But if it is mean field, you're not including more fluctuation.
No. I mean, it's like RG. I mean, I just say that I rewrote these equations to be suggestive. But I believe there is something deeper in there which we still have to understand. And I should maybe say that these fixed points allow you, for example, to calculate almost analytically the prefactor of the pseudo-gap curvature and so on. So let me basically conclude here with a summary of the results. I don't speak about the experiments now. So what we have seen in this large disorder limit is that we have a glass transition that scales like W to the 1 over D minus 1. Below we have replica symmetry breaking. The transition was due to strong fluctuations in the screening. So we have a physical understanding of what is going on. We have power law correlations in the spins. And then in the low temperature regime, we have a pretty strong universality in the sense that we have disorder independence, say, along these lines. Vertical lines don't care about the disorder, basically, in this red regime. And as long as you just vary the temperature, there are some trivial rescalings with temperature, but the low energy sector is completely universal. And of course, it's very suggestive from the form of the flow equations to think that there might be a connection with real RG, where you could maybe think as W as a means of controlling your spatial scale, and then you would see that as you vary your spatial scale, everything is invariant, and so that would be a very interesting perspective to get more insight into this structure of the low temperature glass. I'll stop here then. Thank you very much. Yes?
I just have a question. It's probably obvious, but to make sure. What Yahoo experiments show, so interesting memory effects. They put the chemical potential at some point, and they go in another region, come back, and they see there's some dip. I guess it's a matter of just doing the time-dependent version of this dynamics of this to actually describe these experiments using this mean filter. Is that correct?
I mean it's a very complicated, probably, yeah. Because now, and what they do is changing gate potential, so this new has to be changed, and you would have to keep track what happens with your system as a function of new. Whereas here, all this dynamics happens at the same new. It's pretty complicated. I mean, I've tried to work on that, but on more phenomenological level, and even that is pretty complicated. Yeah. Yes?
I asked this question 2 years ago when you spoke in Grenoble. What about the equivalent?
Yeah. I know now a little bit better answer to that question. So I didn't mention something which is happening already above this transition, namely, if you really look at the distribution of local fields, then there is already a pretty strong gap in the distribution of these local fields. It's just in the distribution of magnetizations, which is hyperbolic tangent of beta y, where there's no feature. But if you look at not at this thermodynamic field Y that I was treating, but at the local field, which is a bit different, then there is a strong structure. And this, we call that the plasma dip, and it's a precursor of the Coulomb gap. And this thing you see in all dimensions. And I think that is what you and Johnson were basically describing.
Even Reich and Ephrus.
Yes, right.
Earlier than us, they saw that in 1D it is logarithmic zero.
Right. So,
and you can develop RG without spin loss transition, without anything, and still have Coulomb gap, right?
Well, but it's just a logarithmic correction to the density of states, and it's not. What I want to say is, it's not clear whether this high temperature feature, as we have here, and the low temperature feature are really the same. Well, when you approach 1D, you probably cannot distinguish between the two. That's my feeling. Yes, exactly in 1D. So
you may sum it up, and that was done by Reich and Ephrus. And gives you Coulomb gap, which is one over law.
Right, yes. What I'm claiming is that probably if you take the limit to D equals 1 of the high temperature physics here, then you would also get something like 1 over log, I believe. So, and in higher dimensions, at least in 3 dimensions, there is this transition, and what happens above the transition is non-universal in the sense that it is just a depletion, but it is not the Ephrus-Chlovsky universal behavior of the Coulomb gap.
Well, what's the situation in relation to experiment with the existence of a transition?
The existence of a finite temperature transition is elusive in experiments because it's not clear. I mean, people are not very motivated to look at the temperature behavior. Or what also happens is that the interesting memory effects and so on that they observe become smaller and smaller as they go up in temperature, and it's not clear how you would really detect this transition. But I think so far, well, there have been some experiments in on the compressibility as a function of temperature in Bell Labs, actually 20 years ago, but this has never been followed up for some reason. So this is still an open question. What seems more exciting is maybe the perspective of a quantum glass transition as a function of other parameters than temperature. So this is another issue.
So we have